Live on tape from the Pioneer 90.1 FM KSRQ studios at the Center for New Media at Northland College in Thief River Falls and streaming worldwide at RadioNorthland.org, it's the independent pro wrestling in Minnesota show. With your host, hailing from somewhere in the extreme northwestern corner of Minnesota, Glenn Broggett.
Hello again and welcome to Independent Pro Wrestling in Minnesota. I'm your host, Glenn Broggett. On today's show is our third and final part of a great interview I did with professional wrestling historian and author George Shire. George put out a fantastic book called Minnesota's Golden Age of Wrestling, from Vern Gagne to the Road Warriors. On the first two parts of the interview, we learned about, in the first part, the early years of the AWA, the early years of Vern Gagne's wrestling career up into the 1970s. In the second part, we learned about the 1970s, what went on in the professional wrestling game in the AWA. And today, we're going to learn about the 1980s AWA. Of course, Vern was just about ready to hang up the boots at that point. And AWA, you know, for a while there in the 1980s, was one of the big premier companies in the world, and they brought in big-time talent. They had homegrown big-time talent, and they were one of the first promotions where Hulk Hogan really caught fire. I guess if you want to trace back the history of Hulkamania, you definitely have to go back to the AWA. We're going to learn about all of that and the demise of the AWA and the rise of the independents in the state of Minnesota. All that and more today in our third and final interview with George Shire, third and final part of a great interview series we did with a fantastic historian of professional wrestling. Let's get back into this interview with Mr. George Shire on independent pro wrestling in Minnesota. We move on in through the 70s into the 80s. It was around around 81 when Vern kind of decided to kind of hang up the boots full time.
Well, yeah, he had actually pretty much slowed down, as I said, you know, around 1975. He did have, you know, some matches through the next 3 or 4 years. He actually took the title back in 1980 from Nick Bockwinkel. And it basically was a, you know, you can say what it was. Vern was putting himself over. It was his own ego. He wanted to retire as champion. That's what the whole deal was. But the key was, and this is something that fans, when they say that, you know, like, well, Vern was putting himself over and Vern was too old, you got to remember that Vern Gagne could still put butts in the seat, and in the seats, and that was the key to it. I can tell you, and I could go back and show you attendance figures through all of his career, that any time Vern Gagne was on a card, depending on the venue and the size of the seating in the auditorium or arena they were at, they could always draw 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 more fans, whatever it was, with Vern Gagne's name on the card. So that was the key to it. And Vern, obviously, he trusted himself. Wrestling was a business of little trust because a lot of wrestlers would not do what they said they would do. A lot of promoters wouldn't always come through with what they said they would do for a wrestler. And so when you had that relationship of trust where Nick got his title, that was important. And Vern wanted to go out as champion. And so he retired as champion by defeating Nick Bockwinkel in his final match. And the one thing that fans didn't like at the time was, instead of holding a tournament for a new champion, they basically, the AWA just said, well, we're giving it to Nick Bockwinkel because he was the most recent champion. And that didn't go over very good.
Oh, no, no,
with the fans. But I'll tell you what they did, and this to me is one of the greatest promotional moves of the 80s and probably in wrestling, as many things I've seen through the years. Nick Bockwinkel wasn't popular because he just had the title handed to him the second time. So what they did was they put him in a match against Sheik Adnan El Casey. Now, for those that remember the Sheik,
oh, yes, I do.
He bragged that he was from Baghdad, Iraq. He bragged that he was going to take the title out of the country. He was a heel to the core. Well, they had him go in some matches against Nick Bockwinkel. Now, even though Nick was still a heel, at that point, the fans got behind him because he was defending the title for America. And he beat the Sheik, after a couple of matches. They had rematches all over the AWA, but it went over well. By the time Nick had gotten through those matches, the fans no longer, because fans' attention spans were short, and that's not an insult, it's just the way it was, and promoters liked that. They had already forgotten how Nick got the title, so then Nick could go back to being his heel and heel ways and wrestle the baby faces. But it was great to put him against the Sheik because the fans forgot how he got the title.
Exactly. And there are a lot. And speaking of the '80s, and the more stars in the making came and went through the doors of the AWA. We're talking about, you know, the Adrian Adonises, the Jerry Blackwells, Kurt Hennig. You know, talk about second generation. A professional wrestler, and of course, the guy who ended up becoming our governor, Jesse Ventura. I mean, these guys
were
huge. And
would anybody have ever figured that one out? I always laugh. I say, you know, if I would have lined up all the wrestlers of 1981 that were active, Nick Bockwinkle, Vern Gagne, Ricky Martel, Tito Santana, you know, you name them, I would have never picked Jesse to be the one to go on to be governor. Oh. But he fooled us, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He made his way in, and he's still out very much visible in pop culture, and he's got his own show. I mean, he's still doing his thing in 2011. He's a very eccentric personality.
Well, here's the thing about Jesse. He was the prime example of a guy who, and Jesse would tell you this, and anybody that worked against Jesse is quick to tell you this. Jesse had very little wrestling ability. As a wrestler, he was very stiff. A lot of guys didn't even like working with him because Jesse was hard to work with. But here's what Jesse had. He had that big mouth. He had that charisma. He had that arrogance. He had that cockiness. And obviously the build. And he copied, you know, he was one of those guys that copied superstar Billy Graham and Hulk Hogan. They were his heroes. And he was so, you know, the fact that he could get you to hate him, and that's what it was all about. I quoted this in my book because Vern had said this to me one time many years ago, that we've got to get him to the auditorium, but when we get him there, we've got to give him a reason to come back. And Jesse could do that. And you know, when you go to the auditorium and you saw the matches, a lot of times there were what they called in the business a screw job finish, where the bad guy didn't win because the referee didn't see the brass knuckles come out and hit him, and the bad guy won, or somebody got disqualified. I mean, there were any number of ways.
Powder in the eyes.
About ending a match, salt in the eyes, and you name it. And so that was the reason to get people back, because you always had to, it was all a soap opera. Get them there today and make them want to come back tomorrow.
You bet I got something to say. You check it out. Ooh, the most beautiful body in professional wrestling. And I got something to talk about. Everywhere I've been going throughout the country, I've been touring with Fleetwood Mac. I've been partying with REO Speedwagon. Why, I've even arm wrestled the Werewolf of London, Warren Zevon.
Well, you know, it's not often Mean Gene. The champions go looking for challengers. Generally, it's the other way around. The challengers look for the champions.
I am the hottest thing in professional wrestling. I am the baddest dude that walks the streets today, Chump Hogan. And you think about that, Chump, because you could not beat me. You could not even beat Sylvester Stallone in the movie Rocky III. It was a draw. I'd have squashed that peanut in 30 seconds.
I'm going to pick up that big Andre. I'm going to press the dude once.
Oh, my.
Press the dude twice.
Jesse,
and then toss him right out of the ring. And Adrian and I are going to walk with 50 grand when just the two of us are left. Ain't that right, Adrian? Right.
Wait. Have you checked out the lateral deltoid lately?
The lateral deltoid?
Check that out.
We talk about Ventura being influenced by Hogan. The arrival of Hulk Hogan. If there wasn't this Hulkamania boom in the AWA, there would probably be no Hulk Hogan. This guy came in with Vern, you know, and the crowds got even bigger. Hulk Hogan, the seeds of Hulkamania, you have to say, were planted in the AWA.
Well, I'll tell you what. Anybody that doesn't remember this, when Hulk Hogan came to the AWA, he originally came in as a heel. Vern wanted to use him as a heel.
Oh, yes.
And he brought in Luscious Johnny Valiant as his manager. The reason he did that was because at the time, Hulk Hogan was very, very limited on what he could do on the microphone. And that may seem surprising when you hear the guy, you know, later on. But in those very early matches, and here's what happened. Hulk had been wrestling for a couple of years down in the South, and he went up to the WWF. He was wrestling up there as a bad guy. Vince McMahon Sr. really didn't use him very well. It was Vince Sr. that gave him the Hulk Hogan name, but they didn't know how to use him. And Hulk was basically going to leave the business. He was pretty much, you know, I'm not going anywhere. I'm big guy, but I'm not going anywhere. Greg Gagne told Hulk Hogan, come and visit my dad. Come and talk to my dad and work with Vern in the AWA. That's what Hulk did. And you're right. Hulkamania was started here. Now, he was started out as a heel, but the fans were cheering him. And eventually they just dumped Johnny Valiant. They let Hulk Hogan kind of mature. They worked with him on his interviews. You saw what he became. Hulkamania was running wild.
Absolutely, and we had him for a while, but of course, as the story goes, he ended up leaving us in Minnesota in the AWA to head on over to Vince McMahon Jr. And he recently had purchased the World Wrestling Federation from his father, Vince Sr., who was in ill health. And that's when things really started to get shaken up on the wrestling landscape. Now, what was the WWF's impact on the territory system, especially the AWA?
Well, the thing about all the territories, Glenn, during those years is you know, as I'd mentioned to you a couple of times, that we had 30 to 35 different territories around the country, all independently run, but either under the jurisdiction of the AWA, the NWA, or the WWF. And all of those promoters basically had a gentleman's agreement in those days that I won't come into your town and promote, and you won't come into my town and promote, and you won't take my wrestlers, and I won't take your wrestlers. They did this for 30 years, and a lot of times they'd call up and say, hey, look, I got this guy. I want to give him some training. Could you use him? Can you do something with him and have him work with some of your boys? This is the way the business was run. Well, when Vince Jr. Took over the business, this was right around the time that cable television was really becoming a boom, and pay-per-view capabilities were starting to become a reality. Closed-circuit television had been shortly before that. And really what Vince realized, and this is why the guy's a genius. I don't like what he did, but you got to give the guy credit for the fact that he recognized that once again, television can help me. And pay-per-views was what it was. But what he wanted to do was he wanted to go around and have a major show in all the different territories. So what he did, first of all, he needed somebody that was big and charismatic that could fulfill that plan, and that's where Hulk Hogan came in. He contacted Hogan. He liked Gene Okerlund, Mean Gene Okerlund, the AWA announcer. Vince liked Gene's style. And Gene Okerlund had more of a flamboyancy about him. He was more of a character in his own right. He was much different from our Marty O'Neill that we'd had years earlier. And so he took Gene, he took Hulk, he also got Jesse, and he took David Schultz, who was one of Hulk's major opponents here in the AWA. Mm-hmm. That was the deal. Hulk said, if I come, I want Schultz to come with me, because we wanted to work against each other.
Absolutely. You know, Schultz, I think, if you people want to say, what, you know, they talk about Steve Austin. David Schultz was like the Stone Cold Steve Austin of the 1980s, I have to say. If you watch any of his interviews and stuff.
Bingo. Yes. Very much so. A very, very talented individual. But that was part of the deal. So the AWA lost Hogan, Schultz, the announcer, and Jesse. And then Vince started to go around to the other territories, and he would take their biggest stars. What he did was he started offering them contracts, which was unheard of in wrestling at that point. Up to that time frame, a wrestler would agree to come into a territory and work for X dollars or X time, and it basically was just one-on-one between the wrestler and the promoter. But Vince changed that by coming up with actual contracts and luring these guys away with, obviously, the pay-per-view and the more exposure. He went into the Mid-South territory that Cowboy Bill Watts promoted in and took the Junkyard Dog and Ted DiBiase. Now, we know Ted DiBiase became the Million Dollar Man for Vince McMahon.
Mm-hmm.
And He went into the Texas area and took the Freebirds. And he went to the, you know, he'd go down to Florida and he'd take, he took the Big Boss Man and people like that. So he started doing, raiding all these territories. And then he committed the cardinal sin, to, according to all the promoters and wrestlers. Vince would go into the various cities, like here in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and he would buy up the auditoriums so that the other promoter couldn't no longer promote a card. And it really became a dogfight, and Vince changed all the rules. Well, when Vern Gagne and Bill Watts and Fritz Von Erich and Bob Geigel and Jerry Jarrett, some of these other promoters in the territories, tried to work together, they couldn't do it because their own egos got in the way.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't agree whose wrestlers from each territory they'd push. And so they blew up. And Vince said, I never had a threat because I knew they couldn't work together. So Vince basically took over the business and eliminated all the territories, and it is what it is today.
And, you know, and Vern, you know, right away, Vern didn't just fold up his tent, though.
Oh,
Vern,
no.
Vern rebounded. He fought because he brought in guys, you know, that still made an impact. Like you were talking about the Road Warriors, and, I mean, there was that Pro Wrestling USA project that, you know, with all the promoters that didn't get back together. But it wasn't like Vern was just laying down. He even went and put on one of his own WrestleManias in Wrestle Rock. Vern was actually trying.
Yeah, every promoter was trying, and it just became more and more difficult. And, you know, the only thing I tell people about the business today versus the way it was is that today what you see on Raw and SmackDown and TNT, there are probably 100 wrestlers that are making any money. There are no more training camps. There are no more territories for any of these guys to get any experience. There are no more... Some of them only wrestle once or twice a month. The rest of it is all just doing their shows on Raw and et cetera. So there are probably 100 wrestlers that are making money versus back in the day, there were 3,000.
Mm-hmm. Now, what?
Do the math.
Yeah, what finally led Vern to just finally give up and throw in the towel back in the early 1990s?
Well, part of it was that for the reasons that I stated. You know, he wasn't able to get the big auditoriums anymore. He wasn't able to get the talent. Any time that he'd sign a wrestler or have a wrestler agree to come in, Vince would somehow grab that wrestler or sabotage it or put a card on the same night. The key thing was is that Vince had a better TV production, you know, and that was the key thing. And that's the other thing that Vince did. He came in and bought up TV time for all the other promoters. He'd come in and put on his show either at the same time or a day away from what the other promoters were doing, and sometimes bought up their TV time with the stations altogether. He went into the Georgia Championship Wrestling, which was TBS at the time, and Vince actually bought the time slot and took it over, and there was no more Georgia Championship Wrestling. So Vince had a lot of money, and he had a plan, and he had the vision, and you give the guy credit for it. But on the other hand, he changed the business. And then he committed the ultimate sin. 1989-1990, he was dealing with the state athletic commissions in the various territories, and he didn't want to pay them. He didn't want to deal with them anymore. So he came out and publicly stated that pro wrestling is not a sport. It's an exhibition. It's entertainment. And all of those old school wrestlers, you know, I can tell you, Vince is probably lucky he didn't end up in the bottom of a river somewhere.
Oh, if it would have been 10, 15 years prior, that probably would have been made of reality.
It would have been.
Oh, and what is your opinion of the post-AWA years and the independent scene that sprouted up more after the AWA shut its doors in the state of Minnesota?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about the independent scene is, you know, there are still some indies out there, but, you know, after 1990... going forward, for every indie card that there is, there's one that just bit the dust. The wrestlers will try to do a lot of things that to be noticed, but you know, as I said, there are no training camps, there are no regular places for them to wrestle, and there just aren't anymore. We mentioned Vern Gagne training wrestlers. Well, he wasn't the only guy that trained wrestlers for the business. Boris Malenko down in Florida, who was a great heel down there for many years, and he was Otto von Krupp for Vern Gagne in the early 60s. But Boris Malenko was a great trainer. Hiro Matsuda was a trainer. Bill Watts would run trading seminars, having Joe Hamilton come in. Jody Hamilton. Mm-hmm. Jody Hamilton was one of the assassins.
Oh yeah.
And there were many trainers. Danny Hodge would work with wrestlers. So, the indie scene is, for the most part, all but dead. And the key thing is they're dead because they don't have TV. They have no means of getting the word out other than, you know, if they can get on a local radio station to try and get a few tickets sold. But they're all run. Wrestling basically returned to the small venues like a gymnasium at a high school or at a local VFW or Legion Hall or something like that. And that's basically what it is today. But they're far and few between. And it's sad.
Oh, very much so. Now, what have you been up to, in the last few years in wrestling, in the professional wrestling game? I see that you've been involved with a great thing called the Cauliflower Alley Club.
Well, the Cauliflower Alley Club is what they call the Ring of Friendship. It's a 45-year organization. It was basically started originally by a guy named Art Abrams and a wrestler named Mike Mazurki. Iron Mike Mazurki, and anybody that watches old black and white TV movies will probably at one time or another have seen Mike Mazurki because he was also an actor. Wait a minute, weren't all wrestlers actors? but he was in a lot of movies. But they started an organization where just a bunch of the boys would get together at the a place called the Old Spaghetti Factory out in California, and they'd meet out there, and it basically was a very closed-end organization with just the boys involved. But about 12 years ago, it was opened up to the fans and anyone connected with the wrestling business. So now it's become a fan reunion and a wrestling reunion, a wrestler reunion. And for several years, I was on their board of directors. I did step down last year after I got my book done and everything, and I've got other things on the fire. I stepped down from that. But the Cauliflower Alley Club is an outstanding once-a-year reunion that is held in Las Vegas, usually in April. And this past year, they had about 450 people there, and there were about 200 of them being ex-wrestlers.
Oh, excellent. That sounds like just a whole bunch of fun. I got to get out there for one of these.
It's a great time.
Now, you've been involved with some podcast wrestling shows, too. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, you know, aside from early years when I used to do wrestling columns and things for magazines, I did do some early wrestling radio stuff that kind of came popular in the late 80s, early 90s. We had a station here in the Twin Cities that did a wrestling radio program, and then one of the sports stations, KFAN, had a Sunday morning program that myself and Wade Keller from the Pro Wrestling Torch.
He does excellent
work. We co-hosted a show together for about 3 years, 4 years in the early 90s. But I've also been doing the internet podcasts for about 6 years now. I did, anybody that wants to Google this, they still can. We did a podcast titled Old School, New School. And it was hosted by Professor Wrestling from Parts Unknown.
Of course.
Professor Wrestling is a guy named Doug Fratelloni, who is a sports writer, and he worked for one of the local TV stations here. And he did this weekly podcast with myself and Dr. Mike Lano out of California, another historian. And so we would talk old school wrestling and new school wrestling. If you Google old school, new school, you can find it and then click on podcasts. And there's like, I think there's 113 or 14 shows out there that you can listen to, and they're all about an hour long. So those are available. But I currently do a weekly podcast with the Pro Wrestling Torch. It's called Torch Nostalgia, and we do it live every Tuesday night at 5 o'clock. And then the last half hour is a VIP section where it's by subscription only. But folks can call in and ask questions about wrestling, and we want it to be nostalgia-based, and so we do that every week.
Okay. Is there any last words you want to say before we end this conversation today?
Boy, I don't know. What more could we add?
I think we've really struck a lot of gold here today, and we've talked about a lot of things.
I would say that I want to thank you. I totally appreciate the opportunity to talk wrestling, because, you know, I think you can tell I could do it forever. And definitely thank you for plugging my book. I hope that anyone that's listened is intrigued and wants to get out. It's available at all Barnes & Nobles and Borders and Amazon.com, and you can order it online as well from the bookstores. So as Marty O'Neill would say, run, don't walk, to get your copy.
And it's a great book, Minnesota's Golden Age of Wrestling, from Vern Gagne to the Road Warriors. A big thank you to our guest today, Mr. George Shire. Thanks so much for educating us on the history of professional wrestling in Minnesota.
It's been my honor, Glenn.
A big thank you to Mr. George Shire for taking some time out with us to discuss history and wrestling in the state of Minnesota. This concludes this edition of Independent Pro Wrestling in Minnesota. Coming up on the next edition of Independent Pro Wrestling in Minnesota, we're going to talk about an independent professional wrestling league that's based out of Bemidji, Minnesota, called Northern Star Entertainment, and we'll be talking with the founder of Northern Star Entertainment, Cal Widowmaker Whitner, and that's on the next edition of Independent Pro Wrestling in Minnesota. And we got one more clip to play. I'm going to play at the end of the show here. It's a 1987 interview with Vern Gagne from AWA Championship Wrestling, where he talks about the changing times of professional wrestling. Independent Pro Wrestling in Minnesota is recorded live on tape at Pioneer 90.1 KSRQ Studios in Thief River Falls, Minnesota. Independent Pro Wrestling in Minnesota is a CTC Select worldwide production. See you next time.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to get back to the wrestling action, the AWA wrestling action, the original wrestling action, after I talk to a man who knows the sport better than anybody I know, none other than the former world champion, Vern Gagne. And Vern, I know you're a busy man. I'm glad you took some time to talk to me today. I want to talk about wrestling. I want to talk about trends that we're all delighted to see.
Well, one of the big trends, I think, is finally, and it's history repeating itself, I'm going back now to Gorgeous George, who was a big star when I started in wrestling. And everybody said, gee, Vern, why don't you let your hair grow long, or why don't you get an earring in your ear or a ring in your nose and do something. I came out of the University of Minnesota. I was Big Ten champion four times. I was a national collegiate champion. I was on an Olympic team. And I said, no, I'm a wrestler, and I'm in here to wrestle. And I think this was way back in the early 1950s. Guys like myself, I think Pat O'Connor, Wilbur Snyder, Dick the Bruiser, Killer Kowalski, changed that trend of all the hype and those days and brought wrestling back to wrestling. And what I mean by that is that people started flocking back to see people like the Killer Kowalskis, the Yukon Erics, and the big, tough wrestlers who were wrestlers. They didn't go for the hype. The hype went out of it. I see the same trend today. I think people have realized they've been fooled long enough by the hype in certain leagues, the WWF League, the NWA. You don't need snakes to win a match. You don't need alligators to win a match. You need to be a wrestler. And when you are a wrestler, you better get yourself in the AWA, where wrestling started. We've always had wrestling in the AWA, and we always will have wrestling.
Not only the fans coming back to see it, but the wrestlers want to get involved in it. People like the Kaniski kid, Nick Kaniski, a kid that you know from way back.
Well, Nick Kaniski is a Canadian Olympic team member, was in the WWF or one of the other leagues, is in the AWA. Many, many other ones. And I'm going to say, even adorable Adrian Adonis realized the hype is over. It is time to get down to wrestle. He's back in the AWA.
Tommy Wildfire Rich, the original Midnight Express. Good, hard wrestlers that want to wrestle the best.
Right. We like excitement and a lot of fun in professional wrestling and in the AWA. But one thing, we've always been a wrestling league, and we always will be. You better be a wrestler when you come into this league, and you fans know it now.
Wrestling, that's what we do in the AWA.